Chapter 5. To Live and Die in the Free Market. The beauty of Mexico, where Chalev and Omri were concerned, was not simply that there was a lot of money to be made there, but that it gave NSO a chance to prove its mettle. Plenty of other companies were jockeying for clients in Mexico, most notably the Milan-based Hacking Team, with offices already in Singapore and Washington, D.C. This was capitalism at work. Competition leads to innovation, which leads to more sales and more satisfied customers and more profits, which draws investment, which affords more innovation and more profits and more investment. So whirs the virtuous cycle at the heart of the free market promise, a cycle that fosters creativity and growth and makes everybody better, depending on your definition of better. A good place to start the story of the virtuous cyber surveillance industry cycle is at an abandoned schoolhouse on the outskirts of Puebla, a metropolis of almost 3 million people living in the shadow of the menacing Popocatépetl, Smoking Mountain, volcano, a 2-hour drive from Mexico City. A young field application engineer for the Hacking Team, let's call him Antonio, arrived at that remote building on a warm spring day to set up a remote control system, RCS, for a new client in the state government of Puebla. Antonio was new to Hacking Team, but his first 3 weeks had been an excellent start for the eager young employee. He was fluent in Spanish, had lived in Mexico off and on for almost 10 years, and had contacts in high places. Antonio's offer to make introductions to family friends among the local officialdom, like the head of security in one Mexican state and the head of a European consulate in another, drew a personal shout-out from the company's CEO back in Milan. "You are on the team," wrote David Vincenzetti. This was an especially welcome note because Vincenzetti was something of a legend in the cyber community, a hacker's hacker, a self-styled cypherpunk who had helped develop and perfect the cryptography that served as the early bulwark of privacy on the internet. Vincenzetti had been a partner in 3 successful cybersecurity firms before he was 35 and then turned to cyber surveillance. He started Hacking Team with one client in 2003, a metropolitan police agency in his home country. His timing was impeccable. In March 2004, less than a year after Hacking Team opened its doors, terrorists exploded 10 separate bombs on 4 commuter trains in Madrid, killing 200 and injuring nearly 2,000. Vincenzetti flew to the city and convinced the understandably abashed Spanish law enforcement officials that he had a tool capable of stopping these sorts of vicious acts before they happened. A way to monitor bad actors on the internet as they coordinated potentially deadly plots. "Privacy is very important," Vincenzetti would say, "but national security is much more important." National security professionals agreed. 10 years in, Vincenzetti had made Hacking Team the premier private cyber surveillance vendor in the world. David Vincenzetti looked the part of predator, lean and alert, with a hint of wiry sinew beneath his slim-fit designer suits, like a hunter who could stalk for days before striking. Vincenzetti claimed to rise at 3 a.m. most days so he could get in a little exercise before he started his workday. He carried himself with the air of a winner, but also of a prodigy and a seer. One business partner from Mexico who spent a couple of days at the Hacking Team headquarters in Milan came away underwhelmed by the offices themselves, but struck by the aura that surrounded the company founder and CEO. Hacking Team was more like a religion than a business, and Vincenzetti a godhead. "These kinds of organizations don't have employees," the visitor says. "They have followers." Vincenzetti had won over scores of dedicated acolytes, a sufficient handful of venture capitalists, and clients all over the world. Hacking Team claimed ongoing deals in 40 separate countries, including in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. The company had also provided its RCS surveillance tools to a handful of discerning federal agencies in the U.S., the FBI, military intelligence units at the Department of Defense, and the DEA. The DEA had signed a deal worth $2.4 million, but even as late as 2013, the bulk of the company revenues still came from Mexico. The sales team was so prolific at that point that it had kind of outrun the company's engineers, which meant Hacking Team had already asked a lot of Antonio, even before he got to the strange abandoned house in Puebla. Though still a trainee, Antonio found himself operating solo from time to time in his first few weeks, like when he handled one unplanned emergency with a client in Querétaro, whose agents were having trouble operating the system and were anxious for an upgrade. This was an unhappy customer that needed both technical support and general handholding, but Antonio assured his bosses he could handle the delicate situation. "I always take the opportunity to have more responsibility as an interesting challenge." That can-do spirit had won the day. By the end of the session, the Querétaro client was talking about buying increased capacity to target more criminals and drug lords and kidnappers. The governor of Querétaro, it was noted among the hacking team managers, was a friend and ally of the new Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto. "The likelihood that he will speak well of hacking team to the president is a fact," said one. "The end goal is for the president to support expansion of the system." So Antonio's future with hacking team looked bright, right up to the last Monday in May, 3 weeks into his employment, when he was ushered into the abandoned windowless schoolhouse by one of the key RCS resellers in Mexico. The reseller had already shown itself less than trustworthy by Antonio's lights. The paperwork at Antonio's previous installation in Campeche was not signed by the client of record, a government prosecutor's office. The official who did sign worked in the Department of Urban Development, which Antonio knew for a fact did not have jurisdiction to use lawful interception on anyone. Here in Puebla, the paperwork was signed by a factotum in the governor's personal office, and the Mexican official on scene to run the RCS cyber surveillance show at the otherwise empty dwelling was well known to Antonio. Was well known to anybody who read the newspapers in Mexico. Antonio cornered the senior member of the hacking team crew at the schoolhouse that morning and said they really needed to talk about what was going on here. But he was waved off and told to get started on the training. At the lunch break, Antonio got his colleague alone again. "I can't do it," Antonio says. "You don't know this guy." "No, I don't know this guy," his coworker said. But the deal was done and the papers signed. "Well, I can't do it. I can't be in the same room with this man." "Listen, you're here to work." "I can't do it," Antonio kept repeating. "I can't be in the same room with this man." The man in question was Joaquin Arnal Romero. And Romero and his close associates were credibly alleged to carry dirty water for the Los Zetas drug cartel. Like, for instance, a little illegal cyber surveillance on an opposition governor. Los Zetas, Antonio explained to his new bosses at hacking team after that first day, is the worst cartel that has ever been. They're not simply narco traffickers, but ex-police and ex-military that also traffic children and manage all kinds of dirty business. I think you understand my ethical worries. Antonio called in sick and stayed in his hotel in Puebla on day two of the installation and training session. Hacking team managers acted without hesitation in what they clearly saw as the company's best interests. The operations unit scotched Antonio's next assignment in Ecuador, which was scheduled for the following Monday, June 3rd. On that day, instead, a memo went out to the hacking team announcing Antonio's departure from the company. They wished him all the best for his future career, but had already put in the works a non-disclosure agreement for his signature. "Yeah, you can leave, kiddo, but keep your trap shut." David Vincenzetti and his management team adhered to the simple and straightforward economic formula that prevails in business these days. A corporation's sole purpose is to maximize shareholder profits. Period. Ethical worries were beside the point. When one of hacking team's exploit developers suggested that perhaps they should be more careful about vetting their end users, a company executive shut him down. "What's your concern with that?" he asked. "Why do you care about things that shouldn't concern you?" Vincenzetti needed good soldiers who kept their heads down, marched forward, and didn't ask questions. "Business is not sport," he liked to say, quoting his favorite computer industry pioneer. "It's war." Hacking Team, circa 2013, could rightly boast something nearing domination in the fight for the cyber surveillance market share. largely because it had developed the most effective and comprehensive cyber intrusion tools to be had. Vincenzetti believed he had already vanquished his strongest foe, Gamma Group, known for its Finfisher cyber surveillance system. "Finfisher is so technologically retarded," he wrote in an internal memo. "It belongs to the remote past." But Vincenzetti was wary by nature, and he instilled this watchfulness throughout his team. So hacking teams saw NSO coming and understood the Israeli startup was delivering just what Mexican clients were clamoring for now: exploits capable of penetrating a variety of mobile phones. NSO had that, hacking team executives conceded, but not much else. Pegasus did not, unlike hacking team's cyber weaponry, have any exploits to invade desktops or laptops. The NSO system did not offer any way to deliver an attack vector except through SMS messages, which require the user to click on it. And the system software was not yet stable enough to provide 24-hour monitoring and clean exfiltration of data. Word among resellers was that NSO's first big client in Mexico, Sedena, was disappointed in Pegasus. Sedena had forked over somewhere north of $15 million to NSO, and Pegasus looked like an expensive flop. The hardware and software components were set up in a state-of-the-art monitoring station, a station the Mexican army had reportedly paid Azano as much as $80 million to construct, where nothing really happened. "I have been there," a hacking team executive reported back to Milan. "And it is a huge new cement two-building bunker that looks deserted, empty, high-tech, and lifeless. I'm not kidding. It is bright white cement and blinding when you walk across the huge patio to get to the entrance. Unlike any other Mexican governmental office I have been to, there are no plants, no decorations, no grass, nothing. Basic waste of money." Vincenzetti and his acolytes had a good laugh at that, and as this confirmed their suspicions that Pegasus was a horse that didn't hunt, they breathed a little easier. But not entirely easy. Because, first of all, NSO was an Israeli company, and recent press about Stuxnet, the spectacular malware that single-handedly set back Iran's nuclear program by years, if not decades, suggested the exploit was built on the brain power of Israeli techs. Israeli technology, Vincenzetti occasionally lamented, was invariably overvalued. More worrisome, NSO's real strength was in selling, and at enormously inflated prices. Shalev Julio and Omri Lave appeared to have discovered the key to unlocking the market in Mexico, and it had less to do with technological capacity than with access to the right people. Azano, they had heard, had taken Pegasus right into President Felipe Calderon's private office. Hacking team had been momentarily buoyed after Enrique Peña Nieto took over the presidency in December 2012. The first months of the new administration spelled trouble for NSO, because Azano was in ill odor with Team Peña. There were whispers that U.S. President Barack Obama had warned Peña, in their first bilateral meeting, that Azano posed a serious threat to good relations between the two countries. Azano's harassment of Sempra, whose subsidiary, SoCal Gas, provided natural gas for more than 20 million people in California, was an issue of national security. When Omri Lave and NSO technicians next arrived in Mexico City to demonstrate Pegasus to the new leaders in the Attorney General's office, according to somebody who was in the room, the highest-ranking government official abruptly turned on his heels and walked out when he saw Azana was also there. Basically, what he said is that this is the last time he wants to see Azano there, the insider says. And the demonstration was canceled. I think after that, NSO understood that Azano was never going to sell to this government. NSO simply pivoted to a new reseller, hacking team believed, an Israeli businessman named Yuri Ansbacher, and his partner, Avishai Neria. An esteemed figure in the Jewish community in Mexico, Avishai was about to be named by President Peña as honorary consul to Haifa, Israel. The guy that sells is Yuri, but the guy that opens the door is Avishai, the government insider says. Hacking team knew that they were going directly to the president, not to lower levels, directly to the president. NSO wasn't just making hay in Mexico. In August 2013, NSO sold Pegasus to the government of the United Arab Emirates, an oil-soaked regime with very deep pockets. The Emiratis could easily pay 5 or 10 times what the Mexicans could, with far fewer middlemen and corrupt government officials who needed a cut of the proceeds. The sale to the UAE was a shot of much-needed cash for NSO, as well as a direct hit on Hacking Team hegemony. The newbie company, much to Vincenzetti's chagrin, was beginning to get fawning press in glossy financial publications. Most of your typical solutions for interception are inadequate, Omri Lave told one reporter. So a new tool had to be built. Omri went on to explain that he could not talk about how his new solution worked or identify any of their customers. I don't want to be beheaded, he joked. In some countries, we're not even allowed to know where the building is, where the system will be installed. Not only are we not allowed in the building, we don't even know where the building is. It could be in another city. At this point, Vincenzetti began to get a tad more manic than usual. He worried about where NSO might next challenge them. Romania? Morocco? Saudi Arabia? Or worse yet, in the private equity market, which afforded the sort of money required to buy new infection exploits or develop new technology. So, Vincenzetti made a big play. Here is my vision, he wrote in an email to his followers in November 2013. The global chessboard, Vincenzetti claimed, had set up perfectly for Hacking Team's next move. He attached a news item from the day before, describing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's unease with the new posture in the Middle East taken by the U.S. and its allies in Europe. Obama's Secretary of State was on a trip to Riyadh, the article noted, where he encountered Saudi Arabia's anxieties over the possibility of a rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran after more than 3 decades of enmity. Vincenzetti wanted to sketch out for his team his own view of the current dynamics of global power. Saudi is now isolated, he wrote. Obama has alienated Saudi, Israel, Turkey, and countless other states who now think we can no longer rely on the U.S. for our security. There are 5 legs of war: land, air, sea, space, and cyber. Cyber is becoming more and more lethal. Aramco, the main oil company in Saudi, has been blocked for weeks by an Iranian cyber attack. And what did all this have to do with Hacking Team? Well, Hacking Team provided cyber solutions, didn't they? Vincenzetti's grand plan was to provide a whole suite of cyber capabilities to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. All the kingdom had to do was buy the company. 3 days later, a London-based venture capitalist with billions in the bank and close ties to the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan Al-Assad, commissioned a Boeing business jet 737 to fly Vincenzetti and his key staff to Riyadh. We will be met at the airport on Wednesday evening, and you will be taken to the hotel which has been arranged for you, wrote the billionaire, Wafiq Saeed, whose Saudi Invest would be running this deal. It is proposed that on Thursday we will meet the relevant Saudi officials led by the deputy minister, and the team will have the opportunity to make a full presentation, including demonstrations. Vincenzetti had already instructed his Hacking Team followers on the proper wardrobe and dispatched his COO to the Saudi embassy in Rome on a Sunday to pick up the necessary travel documents. Which will be open only for you. Makes you think, right? Here we go. The meetings in Riyadh were boffo, according to Vincenzetti. He reported to his team that Mr. Saeed had said afterward that he would give standing orders to my lawyers to execute the transaction in a few days. Hacking Team's current equity partners, meanwhile, had already affixed their signatures to the letter of intent to sell more than 70% of the company to Saudi Arabia or to some newly formed shell company controlled by the Saudis. Of course, a transaction of this scope takes time. Still, a lot of due diligence and lawyering and horse trading to be done. Wafiq's team took a hard look at the Hacking Team revenues for 2013, for instance, and chiseled down the top-line price from $61 million to $49.5 million. Then, just as the final details were being worked out, on February 19, 2014, Wafik's dear friend Prince Bandar was unceremoniously removed as the head of Saudi intelligence. Just like that, the deal was dead. A month later, more bad news. This is a surprise. A mergers and acquisitions specialist emailed Vincent Zeddy on March 20. Everyone said that NSO was in trouble after product issues in Mexico. Apparently, Francisco Partners thought otherwise. Francisco Partners had bought a controlling share of NSO for triple the hacking team asking price in Riyadh, around $120 million. The news reports put NSO's revenue at $40 million in the previous year, dwarfing hacking team's earnings. Vincent said he made frantic efforts to have U.S.-based Francisco Partners roll hacking team into their cyber portfolio. The private equity firm strung them along for a few months and patiently listened to explanations of the ways in which hacking teams was the superior technology. We examined NSO's solution with our own eyes, and we now have clear and incontrovertible evidence that, technologically speaking, they are behind us. We are definitely underselling our product. Francisco Partners took a pass. This was the start of a very bad stretch for Hacking Team. Cybersecurity researchers from Citizen Lab, a Canadian tech laboratory inside the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, issued a series of damning reports in 2014 with forensic evidence alleging that Hacking Team had sold its RCS spyware to more than 20 governments, nearly half of which were considered authoritarian regimes. A number of those regimes, such as the UAE and Morocco, appeared to have used RCS to spy on political dissidents and journalists. Young developers who had taken pride in how the spyware had led to the arrests of more than 50 Italian mafia bosses and driven down the number of Mexican women being kidnapped and sold in Eastern Europe were horrified by public reports that Hacking Team cyber weapons had been used against journalists and political dissidents. A few had even started to talk among themselves about the instances of misuse they were beginning to see with their own eyes. It wasn't until they put an application into the system that allowed you to put data on a computer, says one former Hacking Team contractor, to put pedophile pictures onto somebody's personal computer, and then they arrest them. That's when I was like, shit, this is not good. Vincent Zeddy, meanwhile, was still in his glory. He's a show-off, says one former Hacking Team employee. He had to drive a Ferrari. He wanted to show people he was rich and that he had money. And he didn't give a damn what people did with the system. He would make sales anywhere, to anyone. Gradually, there were more and more operations that were really borderline, says another. Employees and business associates at Hacking Team began to get the eerie sense that they too were being spied on. Vincent Zeddy openly mocked anybody in the company who dared to raise the question of ethics. Why do you care? If a government says a person is a terrorist, he is a terrorist. It's not for us to decide. Attacks from outside the company were met with similar derision. A letter from the United Nations Security Council suggesting that Hacking Team might have violated a ban on sales of military equipment to Sudan drew remarkably ham-handed responses from the company's outside legal counsel. Selling RCS to Sudan was not unlawful. If one sells sandwiches to Sudan, he is not subject, as far as my knowledge goes, to this law, she wrote to Vincent Zeddy. HT should be treated like a sandwich vendor. Vincent Zeddy was sure he was being unfairly attacked, even persecuted, and Hacking Team said as much. Citizen Lab has chosen to target a private business operating in full compliance with all relevant law, a company spokesman offered. We believe the software we provide is essential for law enforcement and for the safety of us all in an age when terrorists, drug dealers, sex traffickers, and other criminals routinely use the internet and mobile communications to carry out their crimes. That was the public response. When the Italian government called a brief halt on the export of RCS, Vincent Zeddy exploded in private. Those who are destroying our company are half-men. They are cowards. They are blind. They don't even live a real life. They'll have to physically kill me to stop me. Despite the hiccups, Vincent Zeddy remained on the hunt and optimistic. He was still banking big on Mexico, which remained Hacking Team's single largest client country and had already spent more than $7 million on RCS. The company had ongoing contracts with 7 different state-level clients in Mexico and the government-owned oil company, Pemex. Revenue from Mexican government agencies was double the amount Hacking Team got from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia at that point, and nearly 4 times the amount from the United States. But the Hacking Team salesmen and engineers were expending a lot of energy trying to calm their most important Mexican client, CISEN, whose operators were complaining that RCS wasn't secure. "We need to put the firewall in for them," a key account manager wrote back to Milan in the late summer of 2014. "I know it is not our job, but it is not my job to just sit back and let a client destroy our reputation only because they are too stupid to install a firewall. We need to fix this because it is blocking our sales in Mexico." Vincenzetti's troops were also losing ground to the now very well-funded NSO, which had just made an unprecedented sale to the Office of the Mexican Federal Prosecutor, PGR. $27.6 million before taxes, promising a capability of 500 simultaneously monitored targets. Vincenzetti was in a swivel after that news, full of nonsensical ideas for besting his rising rival. "So, why shouldn't we do like Oracle did with IBM in the past, boasting its technological superiority and its convenience?" he wrote in an email in early 2015. "Do you remember Oracle's massive comparative ads? Exempli gratia. They booked the back cover of The Economist for years, comparing the Oracle DB with the IBM DB, contrasting IBM's lower performances and high prices with Oracle's much better performance and lower prices." The final blow to Vincenzetti, a live-by-the-sword-die-by-the-sword blow, was heralded by an unexpected message posted on Hacking Team's own Twitter account in the first dark hours of July 5, 2015. "Since we have nothing to hide," read the tweet, "we are publishing our emails, files, and source code." This hijacked tweet was almost 2 months in the making. A very patient and cautious hacker who called himself Phineas Fisher, he had already hacked the rival Gamma Group, would eventually take credit, publishing a technical explanation of how he found a vulnerability in the system software that pried open a backdoor into Hacking Team's internal network. Once through that door, Phineas lived undetected inside the network for weeks, sniffing out passwords, listening in on audio, viewing webcam images, even watching one of the system administrators spend hours of his workday playing World of Warcraft. When he discovered an underprotected server used by the company's software developers, its sales team, and its key executives, Phineas mounted the server remotely and accessed a motherload of company backup files. Within those backups were passwords that gave him access to the live server, as well as the domain admin password, which gave him access to the company's internal emails. He downloaded the emails to his own server, a stealth exfiltration executed against the kings of exfiltration. Phineas continued to live and learn on the network, dancing around and through firewalls to spy on key employees. "One of my favorite hobbies is hunting sysadmins." Until one led him to Hacking Team's crucial asset, the source code for its RCS spyware, which Phineas also downloaded onto one of his own drives. The day after he got the source code, Phineas Fisher took over Hacking Team's Twitter account and made the unexpected announcement that a data dump was coming. Vincenzetti and his team didn't have to wait long to see the hacker make good on that promise. Phineas Fisher dumped everything. 400 gigabytes worth of internal emails, memos, and documents from Hacking Team servers, available to all on a public site. The millions of pages confirmed many of the worst tendencies in Hacking Team's business practices, including sales to renowned violators of civil rights and human rights, as well as the defense of those sales. "The King of Morocco is a benevolent monarch," Vincenzetti insisted in one email. The leak also revealed Hacking Team's growing paranoia and concern about NSO. Vincenzetti and his crew were obsessed with the extraordinary fees NSO was charging, and hot to prove that NSO's claims of having produced zero-click network infection vectors were all make-believe. hacking team had set out to produce a point-by-point memo describing the advantages of RCS over Pegasus. Vincent Zetti's agents plied NSO Group employees with dinner and drinks to try to get them to spill the secrets of Pegasus, according to the company's leaked internal emails. They even tried to infiltrate NSO product demos in Mexico. The Phineas Fisher exploit tripped hacking team, and though it took a few years for the company to actually hit the pavement, the end was a spectacular public faceplant. In the first days of the embarrassing data dump, Vincenzetti pointed the finger at business rivals and jealous foreign governments. Somebody with really deep pockets had to be behind this breach, he insisted. Vincenzetti also tried to frame a handful of disgruntled employees who had left the company a year earlier to start a cybersecurity firm to guard against the sort of cyber weapons hacking team trafficked in. A 2-year-long criminal investigation in Italy was unable to determine the real identity of Phineas Fisher or to pin the breach on any of Vincenzetti's rivals or enemies. But investigators did clear the former hacking team employees of any crime, and they did discover that the most likely reason the hacker got inside the company network was an outdated firewall and virtual private network system. A few former hacking team employees told investigators that the old software was still in the system because one person was still using it. David Vincenzetti. Literally, said one, because he couldn't be bothered to install a software update. Phineas Fisher offered his own statement after the news that the Italian authorities were closing their investigation. Maybe now the prosecutors will have time to investigate the various crimes committed by hacking team, he said. But I don't have any illusions that prosecutors will look into any of that. The now legendary hacker had already published, along with his how-to guide, a kind of manifesto reminding his fellow travelers in tech that they were the best guardians against cyber intrusion. There's plenty of hackers better than me, Phineas Fisher wrote, but they misuse their talents working for defense contractors, for intelligence agencies, to protect banks and corporations, and to defend the status quo. Hacker culture was born in the U.S. as a counterculture, but that origin only remains in its aesthetics. The rest has been assimilated. At least they can wear a t-shirt, dye their hair blue, use their hacker names, and feel like rebels while they work for the man. You used to have to sneak into offices to leak documents. You used to need a gun to rob a bank. Now you can do both from bed with a laptop in hand. Hacking is a powerful tool. Let's learn and fight. The chief beneficiaries of the hacking team leak, to Phineas Fisher's chagrin, did not turn out to be human rights defenders or political dissidents or journalists working in repressive regimes. There was a flurry of calls for regulation of the cyber surveillance industry by a handful of UN officials and NGOs, but that was just talk. The real gold in the leaked data was a handy list of potential customers: Egypt, Ethiopia, Bahrain, Kazakhstan, Vietnam, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia, for instance. Customers who would continue to want cyber surveillance tools and would maybe want to buy them from a company that was not itself easy pickings for cyber intruders. You can see all the hacking team emails with the list of their clients right online, right? Says an Israeli software engineer who was working in cybersecurity at the time. And I think that NSO was the big winner. It eliminated the competition.